Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Iowa PBS. For more than 45 years, Market to Market has provided perspective on the commodities, from farm gate to dinner plate. Find three new agribusiness podcasts each week, the M2M Podcast, Market Analysis, and Market Plus, all available wherever you subscribe and listen to podcasts.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Plenty to come this hour that you'll want to stay tuned for. Later in the hour, a labor economist from Iowa State University explains what's behind this lack of workers to fill so many open positions in the state and across the country. A hint there, it's not simple. It's not one simple explanation, if you heard that. In the second half hour, also the story of how nearly 80 years after a young Iowa man was killed at Pearl Harbor, his remains to be laid to rest in his hometown in Bedford, Iowa. But first, Wednesday of this week, just before midnight, the Iowa legislature adjourned its 2021 session. A reminder here, Monday on this program, we'll have an in-depth look at the new laws passed by Iowa lawmakers, signed into law by Governor Reynolds this past session. I'll have Katarina Sestarek, Kathy Obradovich of the Capital Dispatch, and James Lynch of the Gazette on this program next Monday. But first, let's talk with Stephen Gruber-Miller, State House reporter for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being on. A grueling end, a flurry of activity. Hopefully, you got a little bit of sleep before coming on the line here. I understand quite a flurry of activity.
That's right. A busy final week, some late night debates over controversial bills, but they've all finished their business now.
Okay. Before I ask you to review the most consequential laws from the entire session, give us the highlights of the flurry from this week. For several weeks, it's looked like, well, Republican lawmakers, they are in control, were in no hurry to leave their work, even though their per diem had expired. What was the holdup? And then why did the floodgates open, the rush to the end happen?
Yeah, well, they have a target end date of April 30th, and as you noted, we are well past April 30th, almost 3 weeks past. And so they had been trying to come to a deal on a package of tax cuts, a really broad package that would, in the end, the final deal was reached over the weekend, and they were able to debate it and pass it this week, and it would shift the state's mental health funding from county property taxpayers, where it currently is, to the state. It would also speed up some income tax cuts. It would end the inheritance tax. There are child care and affordable housing tax credits. There's all sorts of other things in there. So it's a really big deal that they had been working on, and they finally got it over the weekend, like I said.
Mm-hmm. Is everybody happy with that? I assume a compromise that they came up with for funding mental health care in the state?
Well, the Republicans are happy. The Democrats have expressed some concerns that this basically means that the mental health system will have to ask the state for funding every year, just like every other program. And they want to make sure that there's a consistent funding source there. And they've said that, in the past, it depends on who's leading the state, right? It can depend on what they want to fund. And so they're worried that in the future, under different leadership, maybe the state won't provide the adequate mental health funding that's needed.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about this quick bill to ban mask mandates that happened late this week.
Right. So this is part of that flurry of activity we were talking about. It wasn't just the tax cut package. They also pass a bill that Governor Reynolds already signed. Actually, she signed it just after the session adjourned, that would ban cities and counties from putting in place mask mandates that are more stringent than the state's. So no mask mandate. And it would also prevent school districts from having mask mandates. And this went into effect immediately. I think the governor signed it after midnight and it went into effect right away. So, children, parents waking up, send their kids to school the next day. And the schools were not allowed to have a mask mandate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's been a real ripple this week. Anybody who's gone out into the public this week, which is most of us, has noticed. And we'll talk about it a little bit later in the hour, how retailers... we are not seeing those signs at storefronts and so forth, and so many mask requirements being dropped here. Let's go back, have you share a few of your thoughts, Stephen. about the session as a whole, the 2021 session, going back to when it convened in January. Consequential. In what ways do you see the highlights this session?
Yeah, I think my main takeaway is that it was a very busy session with a lot of conservative bills being passed. So it wasn't just, the tax cuts kind of capped off the whole session. But even, going back earlier in the year, right away in the session, Republicans passed a law that required schools to offer a 100% in-person option for students. They passed major changes to the state's voting law that cut the early voting period, that closed the polls an hour earlier on election day, and made changes to how people could request and how auditors could process absentee ballots. They have now allowed adults to, beginning July 1st, to carry and purchase handguns without a permit. They've passed a bill that's sitting on the governor's desk that would increase legal protections for police and raise penalties for some protest-related crimes. So the list really goes on. It was a major list. There's a long list of consequential changes that are becoming law this year.
Yeah, and comment for a moment on the abortion activity by Republican lawmakers, because we saw at the U.S. Supreme Court this week, they took up a case, I believe a Mississippi case, that could have dramatic changes in store for the landmark Roe v. Wade.
Right. So to understand the abortion debate in Iowa, you have to go back to 2018, when the Iowa Supreme Court issued a ruling that found that the Iowa Constitution does protect a fundamental right to abortion. Republicans have not been pleased with this ruling. They say that essentially the court was making new law. It was changing the Constitution on its own and finding a right that never existed there. And so they've been trying since then to pass a constitutional amendment that would essentially nullify that Supreme Court decision and say the Iowa Constitution does not secure a right to abortion. So even just this week, the House and the Senate, Republicans agreed on some language for that amendment, and they passed it through both chambers. And so what that means is after the 2022 election, the lawmakers have to pass it again, the same language. And then at that point, it could appear on Iowans' ballots in 2024 for a statewide vote.
Looking back at the session, how many of Governor Reynolds' priorities were addressed and passed? She get everything she wanted?
She didn't get everything she wanted, but she got quite a few things. The tax cuts being a big one, she got a range of what she was calling school choice proposals. She's expanding the state's charter school system. She'd made some other education changes. Several things that she was looking for. She's got a ban on vaccine passports that she signed yesterday, but she wasn't able to get some of the things on her agenda done, including a ban on racial profiling that she proposed at the beginning of the year, and also a system of essentially scholarships that would use taxpayer money to help some students attend private school. That did not get support to pass. So there were a few things. And then also she had made a last minute sort of call on national television on Fox News for the legislature to pass a bill that would limit transgender women and girls from being able to participate in girls' sports. And the legislature never put forward a bill that would do that.
Mm-hmm. Of course, for several years, we've had Republican unified control of government here in Iowa. A quick word on how the minority Democrats see this session.
Yeah, they're not pleased. As I mentioned, there's a long list of conservative priorities that got enacted, and their criticism from the Democrats is that Republicans really focused on divisive issues this year, and essentially that they didn't do enough, that they ignored or didn't do enough to address the coronavirus pandemic. And Democrats were saying, listen, we had these plans that could have addressed the pandemic. We were ready to work together. And they don't feel like Republicans took up that call to address the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the mask mandate has been a big area of contention in the state house itself this session, right?
Yeah, that's right. The legislators came back into session in January under rules set by the Republicans that did not require anyone to wear masks, that did not require anyone to disclose a positive test. So throughout the session, they never had to shut down the session over COVID, but there were at least 10 cases of COVID among people in the building. There could have been more, but again, positive test reporting was not required, so we don't know for sure how many people may have gotten sick.
Mm-hmm. And on in the unfinished business category, certainly the census data, which is needed for a once-a-decade reapportionment late due to the pandemic, that data not there. Therefore, the reapportionment can't happen. What does this mean for Iowa lawmakers?
That's right. Well, there's still some uncertainty about what exactly will happen, but I think the operating assumption is that lawmakers will probably be back for a special session later this year, possibly in August, once the census data is released, and that will allow them to, the Legislative Services Agency, a nonpartisan agency, draws the legislative maps, and then the legislature will be there to vote those maps up or down. So they expect to be coming back once they get that data later this year.
Catching us up on news from the Iowa Capitol, Stephen Gruber Miller, State House reporter of the Des Moines Register. Stephen, always good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this was the week when many of us became unmasked. Out shopping, you saw many retailers dropping mask requirements. We'll hear more about that in just a moment with Philip Jones of the Des Moines Register. Of course, then late this week, Governor Reynolds signed a bill into Iowa law, a ban on mask mandates in cities, counties, schools. Let's check in with Natalie Krebs, our health reporter here at Iowa Public Radio. Hi, Natalie.
Hello, Ben.
Another busy week, things changing very quickly. Last week, we had the CDC announcement that fully vaccinated people no longer need to socially distance or wear masks indoors, with some exceptions. Talk a little bit about, because I know you reported on it this week, about the challenges many of us are having with this drastic change. It's coming very quickly after more than a year of masking up and staying safe.
Right, exactly that, Ben. This big change last week by the CDC's guidelines, which was a huge change. You know, it was exciting for many. They were like, yes, we can go back, do a lot of the same things we used to be doing before without a mask. That's if you're fully vaccinated. But for some people, it's quite stressful. You know, we've been living under these strict guidelines for more than a year, you know, wearing masks in public spaces, really socially distancing, restricting our activities. And it's a big change to suddenly all of a sudden throw that all away, all while the pandemic is still going on. So I spoke to an Iowa State psychologist, Douglas Gentile, this week, and he basically said, if you're fully vaccinated and you're still really nervous about going to restaurants, you're still wanting to wear your mask out to public spaces, that's okay. And you should do that. And, you know, when it comes to dropping masks, you know, we should still be kind of aware of others. And even though the CDC says if you're fully vaccinated with other fully vaccinated people, it's okay to not wear a mask, you know, Gentile recommended that we might still want to ask people and say, you know, is it okay if I take off my mask? I'm fully vaccinated.
Right. And I heard a great tip, like if you're at a restaurant, a cafe or something like that, and the server comes over, they have a policy in that particular restaurant of having a mask. And there's a lot of people that they come across in the course of the day that, you know, do others the courtesy. As you said, think of others when you have this newfound freedom. If you want to go maskless, think of others and then have your mask on at the ready. So that's really great advice. And then just take it at your own pace. Don't get stressed out about it. Even though you're fully vaccinated, as you say, feel free to wear your mask and drop it as you feel safer and safer, and hopefully we will not see a resurgence of the virus. Talk about what you're hearing, Natalie, on how schools, students, staff, and parents are coping with the ban on mask mandates in schools.
Well, it's just been a big change, especially for schools. You know, we had the CDC guidance change, and then shortly after that, last Friday, the Iowa Department of Public Health changed their guidance for schools, basically saying kids or schools should no longer, you know, be requiring kids to wear masks, or they should really give them the option. And then they no longer need to quarantine students who have had a possible COVID-19 exposure. Now, these guidelines are beyond what the CDC says. The CDC is recommending loosening these restrictions for people who are fully vaccinated. Obviously, that doesn't include most children, not nearly all children, as mm-hmm. even the Pfizer vaccine has not been authorized very long for kids 12 to 15. So, you know, obviously this week we saw the governor sign legislation. It basically made it so schools can no longer require masks. It's been a big change in schools. We've seen a lot of districts that have had to drop their mask mandates basically towards the end of the school year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, there's a big disagreement there. Some parents, students, horrified that suddenly they're expected to attend school without a mask mandate. Other parents, yeah. other students, grateful to make their own decisions about masking after months of their experience of frustration. So there we have two sides of it. Let's finish up with talking a little bit about, as we like to do, where we are in terms of the Iowa COVID data. What does that look like on this Friday?
Yeah, so we've seen hospitalizations kind of steadily drop for the last couple weeks. So they're hovering in the 140s now. I think they're about 146 today. Vaccinations still continuing to go down. We're looking at numbers as of, you know, this morning, about 1.3 million Iowans had completed their COVID-19 vaccine series. So that's somewhere around 50% of those who are eligible. So that's like the Iowa population 12 plus. So we're making progress, but very slowly. Again, you know, with that number being around 50%, we're nowhere near herd immunity, especially even lower when you're considering the entire population of Iowa is about 3.1 million. So, you know, the pandemic goes on.
Right, and it does. And again, we can't emphasize this enough. It's still advisable to be safe out there. Earlier this week, and I know you've spoken with him as well before, Natalie, Dr. Stanley Perlman, a researcher at the University of Iowa, one of the world's foremost experts on the coronaviruses. You know, he thought the CDC guidelines was, I think in his words, a bit premature. You know, these things can be hard to judge, and there are a lot of factors going into it. But Natalie, to end up here, it's never a bad decision to continue to be safe at your own comfort level, and what? Emphasize again, be respectful of others, right? And their concerns as we emerge from this very dark pandemic.
Yeah, exactly, Ben. And, you know, just to bring up some of that advice I was talking about earlier, you know, we've all been through different situations in this pandemic. You know, for some people, it was really kind of being cut off socially, but obviously more than 6,000 Iowans have died from this. So a lot of people have lost loved ones, been through mm-hmm. significant trauma. So just remember that as we move forward for this, you know, people's emotions are really going to vary. People have been through very different experiences in this pandemic.
Okay, thank you very much. Natalie Krebs, IPR's health reporter. Thank you, Natalie. Have a great rest of your Friday and on into the weekend as well.
Thanks, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Very long list of retailers dropping mask requirements since the CDC announced last week that people who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19 no longer need to wear masks indoors, except in crowded settings, for instance, in planes, buses, healthcare facilities. Philip Jones joins me now, once again, breaking news and public safety reporter for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Philip.
Hey, Ben. Good to hear from you again.
Good to talk with you. You've been focusing your reporting this week on how businesses here in Iowa, retailers, are reacting to the new guidelines and circumstances. What can you tell us?
Well, Hy-Vee, maybe Iowa's best-known retailer and best-known grocer, of course, announced earlier this week that customers and staff members would no longer have to wear masks in stores if they are fully vaccinated. This announcement, as most of these announcements did, came with a caveat that for unvaccinated customers, the guidance still remains the same. But it's largely being seen as a win for people who oppose wearing masks.
Right. And of course, any business, Hy-Vee or any business, is in the position of sort of evaluating. You inevitably have a mix of different customers. Some people still very anxious about being infected. Others joyful to be free of restrictions. So I guess putting yourself in a business owner's, retailer's shoes is hard to do at this point, Philip.
It is. You know, businesses are in a tough position right now. You know, a lot of businesses were caught off guard by this change in guidance from the CDC. And this really puts businesses in a position where some of them feel like they have to figure out if they can judge whether a customer is vaccinated or not, which frankly is impractical in most cases.
Yeah, and impossible. We're all on our honor, on the honor system when it comes to, you know, if you walk into a store, a cafe, a restaurant without a mask on now, you know, people are trusting. Your fellow Iowans are trusting that you are fully vaccinated, but who knows? I wonder, Philip, what does this mean for employees of Hy-Vee and other businesses?
First thing is that it's another step back to normalcy if they don't want to wear masks. You know, I think masks have kind of signified in grocery stores, you know, that grocery store and other retail employees were really people who were on the front lines. You know, there were a lot of cases of retail employees in mostly in other states, but who died from COVID-19 early on in the pandemic. And this is yet another sign that the country is getting back to normal. You know, for those who were resistant to wearing masks, you know, they can go back to their daily routines, and it just means that that stores will look a little bit more normal.
Mm-hmm. What other voices are you hearing out there as a public safety reporter with this? This is really a drastic change we've had in the last few days. The CDC guidelines from last week, new guidelines for schools, and then the governor banning mask mandates in a variety of public settings. So what do you have your eyes on now?
You know, I think when it comes to retailers, you know, the majority of people in those stores are adults who've had the opportunity to get vaccinated. You know, Hy-Vee, as part of this announcement, reminded people again that people can walk in for vaccine appointments. Now they no longer have to have an appointment scheduled, though they certainly still can. Don't forget that even last week, Des Moines dropped its mask requirement in public because conditions were improving so much.
Yeah, and we'll watch this in the coming weeks, all of our fingers crossed here, and that people keep safe. Philip Jones, thank you so much, breaking news and public safety reporter with the Des Moines Register.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, well, we've seen those help wanted signs everywhere. I'll talk in just a moment with Iowa State University labor economist Peter Orazum about the desperate need for workers to fill positions. That's when we return. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Iowa PBS. For more than 45 years, Market to Market has provided perspective on the commodities, from farm gate to dinner plate. Find three new agribusiness podcasts each week, the M2M Podcast, Market Analysis, and Market Plus, all available wherever you subscribe and listen to podcasts.
And we're back with this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Help wanted, now hiring. Signs, they're everywhere in Iowa and across the country. Well, let's dig into this desperate need for workers to fill many vacant positions with Peter Orazum. He's professor of economics at Iowa State University, a labor economist. Peter, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's hard not to see all the signs, hear the complaints of business owners who can't find workers. Give us a big picture overview of the severity of this labor shortage.
Well, if you look at data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, they compile information on the number of vacancies and the number of hires, and there were 18 1.8 million more vacancies last month than there were hires. So there's a huge excess demand for workers.
Mm-hmm. So what stands out for you as an economist about this shortage? Why is it happening? What are the factors here?
Well, there are various factors that people have pointed to, and none of them seem to have the complete story. One is that there's been a reduction in the availability of daycare. So if you look nationally at the number of daycare workers, it declined 14%. So a lot of daycares have closed, and that means that more parents have to stay home. And one of the ways to stay home is to drop out of the labor market. A second is that there are people who are concerned about the pandemic, and they feel that they'll be more exposed to the disease if they're at work. And so if they can't work from home, they also drop out of the labor market. And the third reason that people have pointed to is the historically large compensation, the added compensation for unemployment benefits. And that increases the incentives to not work and to stay at home.
It's good to get a sort of a differentiated explanation with many factors. So it's a mixture of all these things. Is there a way for an economist to sort things these out, or we just have to deal with kind of a scrambled egg as explanation there that you can't sort of untie it?
Well, it's awfully hard to identify these things sort of in real time because the data comes at a lag. But we will have a unique opportunity where several states, I think 22 states, have said that they're going to abandon the extra payments, the $300 per week for unemployment benefits within the next month. And
including Iowa on June 13th.
When that happens, we should be able to see if, in fact, you get a surge in labor force participation in those states relative to the states that are retaining that. And so I think that natural experiment will be a rare opportunity for everybody in the U.S. to see what we would mean by a policy experiment.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any predictions when the results of that experiment eventually come in?
It is very hard to believe that the change in unemployment benefits isn't going to serve as an incentive to enter the labor market. Number one, because there are so many extra jobs that are going begging at the moment. And secondly, there's work that was done by the University of Chicago that suggested that a very high fraction of the people who are receiving these extra benefits, particularly the early ones that were more generous, $600, I believe, additional per week, that many of those workers were actually being paid more unemployed than they were employed. So it's hard to believe that abandoning that extra payment isn't going to have an effect on labor force participation.
Mm-hmm. Does this labor shortage affect some sectors more than others?
Well, there are sectors that are growing and sectors, of course, that are shrinking. So the sectors that shrank the most in the pandemic were the ones with face-to-face server interactions with customers. So restaurants, the entertainment sector, hospitality, transportation, particularly passenger transportation. And those areas of the economy were really dealt a severe blow. Meanwhile, other sectors of the economy actually expanded. And so, for example, as Hy-Vee and Walmart are increasing their demand for workers, mom-and-pop restaurants were shuttered. And so you get a shift in where you get increases in jobs and where you get a decrease in jobs. Here more recently, it was really surprising to us to hear that John Deere had said that they had 300 vacancies and could only fill 50 of them. And you say, well, how could that be possible at a company that offers relatively good pay and great benefits? And if you dig a little bit deeper, if you look at manufacturing, for example, here in Iowa, while durable goods manufacturing, including John Deere, lost about 6.8% of their jobs, you know, between March 2019 or March March 2019 and March 2021, non-durable goods manufacturing actually expanded. So the people who are producing food, for example, and so some of the shift in manufacturing is a shift from people who would have been doing durable goods manufacturing to non-durable goods manufacturing. And of course, those people then are employed, and it's hard for John Deere to find them. And if you look at another sector that expanded dramatically over the last year or so, construction increased. So if you look at the increase in employment in construction and non-durable goods manufacturing, it roughly is the exact opposite of the decline in employment in durable goods manufacturing. So it may be that some of the people that John Deere would have normally relied on to hire as they were wanting to expand, those people are already employed in either construction or non-durable goods.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Peter Orazim, professor of economics at Iowa State University. Thanks for the overview. Very complicated, very fascinating, though, Peter. Thanks for your insights.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's taken nearly 80 years since his death, but soon William D. Tucker will find his final resting place in his hometown, the southwestern Iowa community of Bedford. On December 7, 1941, Tucker was aboard the battleship USS Oklahoma, which was moored at Pearl Harbor. And on that day, the ship was, of course, attacked by Japanese aircraft. Hit by several torpedoes, it quickly capsized. 429 crewmen, including Tucker, died. Joining us with the story of how William Tucker's remains were identified to be brought home, Sergeant First Class Sean Everett. He's a public affairs specialist for the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency based in Washington, D.C. Sergeant Everett, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Ben, and you can call me Sean.
Very good. Take us back to December 7th, 1941. Tell us more about what happened specifically to the USS Oklahoma on that fateful day.
As you've already covered, the USS Oklahoma was moored on Battleship Row there at Pearl Harbor when the Japanese did their surprise attack there on our facilities in Hawaii. And the USS Oklahoma did, in fact, sustain multiple torpedo hits and quickly capsized. 429 crewmen, including William D. Tucker, died that day. So between December 1941, after the attack, and June 1944, Navy personnel worked to recover the remains of all the deceased crew of the USS Oklahoma, and they were interred in a couple of different cemeteries there in Hawaii. But in September 1947, the American Graves Registration Service, they disinterred all of those remains in an effort to identify those service members, because at this point, we didn't know who those people were. We knew they were crew of the USS Oklahoma, but we didn't know specifically who they were. They were able to identify some of those people, but most of them they were not. There were 394 sailors and Marines who were buried at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific there in Honolulu and were buried there as unknowns.
So take us a few decades ahead. I assume that's the next chapter, significant chapter in this story, and it involves the founding of your organization and its mission. We're into the 1970s and 80s?
Yes, so the DPAA is the organization now, the DoD organization now, who our mission is to account for missing and unaccounted for service members and DoD civilians from our past conflicts, ranging from World War II, the Korean War, the Cold War, Vietnam, and even into our more modern conflicts in the Middle East. However, we've only been around since 2015. Before us, there were predecessor organizations that existed that have been doing this job, that have been doing this mission since, like you said, the late 70s, early 80s.
Mm-hmm. And so it was only with the advent of DNA technology that these remains, which had been interred in Hawaii for decades, could be positively identified. It was an unmarked grave, I understand there, but they could be positively identified as William D. Tucker in this case.
Yeah, so basically what happened is in 2007, we disinterred, or a predecessor organization disinterred one casket from the USS Oklahoma. And in that casket, there were remains of several individuals. There were a lot of bones that were found and not in, you know, not in complete skeletons, basically. Yeah. And so it was the advent of DNA technology, and we were able to, we determined, one, that there were multiple people buried in that one coffin. And then, based off of that and the DNA technology, we were able to get an ID. We identified six people between 2007 and 2010. Between June and November of 2015, we exhumed all of the USS Oklahoma unknowns there at the cemetery there in Honolulu. Mm-hmm. Since then, we have identified 338 of the 394 sailors and Marines still that had been unaccounted for after World War II.
What can you tell us about William Tucker's family? Does he have any known family left? This is, he died at the age of 19, some 80 years ago. And of course, because he was killed in that attack, he was not allowed to have any family. He does have, he has no descendants in that way. What can you tell us about him?
I do know that he has a nephew who is still alive. He does not live there in Iowa any longer. He lives in Utah, but he is, he has been talking with the Navy Casualty Office, which is the casualty offices for each of the services. Those are the people who do the genealogy to find living relatives of these people that we ID. And they're the ones who contact those families and talk with those families and let the families know that we have identified someone, and, you know, and then they help the families make funeral arrangements and travel arrangements and those kinds of things. And through them, we do know that, that Tucker has a nephew who lives in Utah, who is involved in bringing William home.
Talk about that. That's to come. He will be buried, according to your information, June 30th of this year, in just a few weeks, in his hometown, Bedford, here in Iowa. Can you give us a preview of what that funeral's to be like?
Most of the people that we identify and that are returned home, they are buried with full military honors. Now, that means they have military escorts. There's typically a military flag team. There's a military bugler. There's typically a 21-gun salute, that kind of thing. And he is to be buried with full military honors there in Bedford.
Sean, does it surprise you? You're a member of the military. Thank you for your service. Does it surprise you that after so many years, I find myself just reading this story, the press release that your office released, and finding it really moving? What are your thoughts on how something so far in the past can move us in this way?
In the military, we have a mantra of never leave a fallen comrade. And that mantra is something that DPA takes very, very seriously. Military folks are not always able to, you know, recover their fallen comrades. They're in the heat of battle, or there will be, you know, depending on the war and the battle, there could be prisoners of war and those kinds of things that we were unable to recover. But DPAA's mission is to make sure that that mantra, never leave a fallen comrade, remains true. And we go out and we try to find those that are missing or identify those like Tucker who were buried as an unknown in the United States, it's our job to find an account for these people, not only for to fulfill that promise of never leaving a fallen comrade, but also we do it for the families. Many of these families are, you know, they have a hole where this person, you know, this person filled this hole in their family, and then they were killed, but they were never able to be brought home and never able to be buried with the family. Or, you know, some families choose to have their loved ones buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Or there's even several that are buried there at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific in Honolulu, or at any of our national cemeteries across the United States. By fulfilling our mission of finding and recovering and identifying these people, we help fill the hole that may exist in these families' lives, but we also kind of give comfort or assurances to active duty military people that if they happen to fall during battle, even if they're not recoverable right then, there are people out there whose mission it is to find them and recover them and bring them home.
Okay. Thank you very much for telling us the story. Sergeant First Class Sean Everett, Public Affairs Specialist for the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency based in Washington, D.C. That funeral of Navy Fireman First Class William D. Tucker, 19 years old, when he died of Bedford, Iowa, he will be brought home, given a proper funeral in his hometown in southwestern Iowa. He died December 7th, 1941, at Pearl Harbor. Thank you, Sean. Take care.
Thank you very much, Ben.
And we end this Friday News Buzz edition of River to River with our groove into the weekend. Cece Mitchell is with me from IPR Studio One. She's a Tracks host there, Studio One Tracks host. Hi, Cece.
Hey, Ben. How's it going?
It's going well. I'm waiting for this sunshine that Dennis has promised us. But you can bring us some light or something uplifting, I think, in the song category. What do you have? We have time for one song.
I'll try my best. So earlier this week, I actually got to talk to this really interesting guy on Tracks on Wednesday night over Zoom. His name is Cass Haley, and that might be a recognizable name because he actually came in second place in one of the early seasons of America's Got Talent. That's actually how he got his career started off. He's from Texas, the same part of Texas I'm actually from, Arlington, and so he's going to be at XBK this Sunday. XBK is a venue in Des Moines that we have a real good relationship here at Studio One, touring on his new album. It's called All the Right People, and it's just a really fun sort of music. I don't know exactly how to describe it, like reggae, soul, pop. It's very unique, so it's sure to be a really interesting time, and this is one of the tracks from it. Every road I'm on.
Broken dream. Lately I've been snooping round for meaning. Breaking ground to grow the things I need. Said sunshine, rain, a storm, yeah. It's all the same. Blessings always come. Rearrange. Sunshine, rain, a storm, yeah, it's all the same. Blessings always come. Rearranged, yeah, they do. Right.
Cass Haley, very good choice. Every Road I'm On, C.C. Mitchell. Check out the new music, old favorites as well. Iowa Public Radio Studio One tracks. C.C., along with her colleagues, Mark and Tony, do a great job for the weekend or the weekday. C.C., thank you very much. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too. Thanks.
River to River today, produced by Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful weekend.
Blessings always come rearranged. Says sunshine, rain, a storm, yeah, it's all the same. Blessings always come rearranged. Yeah, they do. Dum bum 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 bum. Oh yeah, here they come.